now on Bloomberg 1200.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody, do your job.
And together, we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Morody and Ann Mustu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
That's right. This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mostu here in our Bloomberg 1200 studios in downtown Boston with my co-host, Tom Maroney.
Yes. Hi, Ann. And coming up on our show today, the summer labor shortage. It is real and it's about to hit your favorite vacation spot. Can you say Cape Cod?
Yeah. The tangled web of regulations around the emerging marijuana industry is another thing we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But first, let's do a market check, Tom.
Let's do that. It's been a fairly interesting day on the markets. U.S. stocks rose to an all-time high amid a robust jobs report. So the S&P 500 had its first record close since March 1, closing up about 10 points at 23.99. Dow Jones up 55 points, closing at 210.06. NASDAQ up 25 points at 6,100. What about the local scene, Ann?
Well, the Bloomberg Boston Index, tracking the area's biggest publicly traded companies, was up 0.3%, just slightly this week, at 129.91. Pretty good day for jobs, though, here in the U.S.
That's right. That jobs report was big. So let's take a look at winners and losers. And this week you've drawn the long straw.
Yes, I'm going to talk about the leaders, the winners here in the terminal. PerkinElmer up 1.84% this week. Cognex up 1.6%. Iron Mountain had a good week, up 1.5%. And Tesoro up 1.1%. How about the losers?
Okay, Tom? The losers on that side of the ledger, we have Biogen in Cambridge down about 2.5%. Akamai in Cambridge, Akamai Technology down 1.4%, and Vertex, the pharmaceutical giant in Boston, down about 1.3%.
That's right. We'll have the Akamai CEO on next week, but we'll have more about that in a bit. We have something special to talk about first. All next week, Bloomberg Television and Radio lands here in Boston, downtown, to take an in-depth look at regional innovators and top companies ranging from burgeoning robotics and biotech startups. And we'll also talk to venture capitalists and some top state officials about their hopes for the tech economy. And one of our guests is going to be Harvard's President Drew Faust, who sat down with Bloomberg in advance of next week. We talked to her about how there are just fewer than 20 days until one of Harvard's most famous alumni, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, will deliver the commencement speech. So we asked President Faust how much of a role Harvard plays in the world of innovation.
And I've spent a lot of time working with individuals in Congress this spring trying to make the case for how research operates and how universities are dependent on a longstanding partnership with the federal government and on federal support. We've also been concerned about immigration issues and the free flow of talent. I think our greatest advantage as a country in this sphere has been the attraction that we can pull people with to the United States. And we benefit enormously from that.
Yeah, and as President Faust continued, remember Mark Zuckerberg, the commencement speaker, I'd point this out, Ann, he did not receive his diploma.
Right.
So this honorary degree that comes with the speech will be his graduation from Harvard.
Right.
So as I said, Faust continued, and she talked about how Harvard is impacting innovation and the talent pool.
We have such a vibrant innovation community in so many dimensions here, and it's exciting to see it growing. It's exciting to see the output, and I think that having Mark Zuckerberg come back is going to be a great moment for everyone to celebrate him and to remind ourselves of the many ways in which we have been innovators and will continue to be innovators.
That's, again, Harvard President Drew Faust. You'll hear the Bloomberg Tech Show simulcast in the 5 o'clock hour here on Bloomberg Radio, Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2. And then a week later on May 15th, the Bay State Business Hour with your host, myself and Tom, will begin to broadcast the show daily. How exciting is that?
Every day.
I know, we're excited.
In the same studio, and I wish you luck with your co-host. Let's talk a little bit more briefly about this great tech lineup we have next week. Yeah. So we talked about Drew Faust. She, her interview will air on Wednesday. At that point, the technology show will be on site at the Harvard Innovation Lab.
That's right.
So that should be a great night. We'll also have Steve Pagliuca there of Bain Capital. He's also co-owner of the Celtics. He gave a generous gift so that next to the Innovation Lab there on Western Ave is the Pagliuca Life Sciences Lab. It's got his name on it. And so he'll talk about that. I mean, he's into a lot of things, but we're going to focus that night on life sciences, biotech. It's a wet lab, so it's a lot of biology in there.
Yeah. And again, all week, Bloomberg Tech and Radio and a lot of our daily radio shows are going to be broadcast out of Boston. Mm-hmm. We start with the Chamber of Commerce on Monday, mm-hmm. the Museum of Science on Tuesday, Harvard Wednesday, as Tom mentioned. Mm-hmm. Thursday, we're at General Electric after their groundbreaking, mm-hmm. and then Friday at Mass Robotics. Mm-hmm. Great CEOs, lots of big names lined up. We've worked really hard all week to book, really for a month, to book a bunch of really great guests. So it's going to be a lot of big CEOs.
Yeah, big CEOs. We have Akamai Technology. We mentioned them in our stock report today. CEO will be with us on Monday, as will the governor, Governor Charlie Baker, as will Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. These two, as you know, Ann, really helped bring GE to the city. So we're kind of closing the circle here. On Thursday night, as you say, we'll have GE and we'll have the CFO, Jeff Bornstein. So a lot to look forward to. But right now, looking forward to the rest of our program here coming up, marijuana. And do the state's laws as written bode for a healthy industry? We'll talk to an expert from Boston's Foley HOAG and later the summer labor shortage. I'm Tom Maroney along with Ann Mastu. This is Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mastu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
That's right. This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mastu here in our Bloomberg 1200 studios in Boston's Financial District with my co-host Tom Maroney. And in studio with us is Jesse Alderman, an associate at Foley HOAG. And he is a lawyer studying and working on the current regulatory framework for adult use and medical marijuana. Welcome, Jesse.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in.
Jesse, tell us, start with this. You have opened a marijuana practice. I mean, tell us how this works. What are you doing?
Sure, Tom. Well, we represent clients in Massachusetts in a host of highly regulated industries, energy companies. We represented gaming companies, developers who have to go through a litany of state and local permits and federal permits sometimes as well. So it was a bit of a natural fit for us to look at what is very clearly a growing industry in the Commonwealth and see the parallels between what we do in terms of offering strategic advice, but then offering regulatory advice on a variety of complex issues. So for someone like me who does real estate and environmental work and all the zoning work that goes along with finding sites to cultivate and process marijuana as well as to sell it and the interaction with the state regulatory bodies at this point on the medical side, the Department of Public Health, as well as municipalities, we thought it was a natural fit. And we've been doing some work in this area for a while. But with the advent of the recreational or adult use, as some people call it, referendum that passed in November, we've been seeing a lot more interest and somewhat formalized a practice area around it. Mm-hmm. And we're thrilled to do so.
Jesse, one of the questions I hear people ask a lot is, how can I invest in marijuana, either or both recreational and medical in Massachusetts? Is it what's legal to invest in right now, or what are the opportunities?
Okay, so let me unpack that question just a little bit. Yeah. Marijuana is illegal under the Controlled Substances Act at the federal level in any way, shape, or form. So while there's a varying degree of complexity to some of the investment structures that institutional capital investors are using to put money in either on the medical side or we don't have a recreational market yet, but you know, in anticipation of that, right. They know that under the Controlled Substances Act, the business that, you know, the whatever entity the money is ultimately going to is engaging in is not legal at the federal level. That being said, there is a lot of complexity with how to invest at the state level in a medical marijuana treatment center. The reason being that there is a statutory requirement in the referendum that the voters passed in 2012 that they be not-for-profit entities.
Right.
So there are limitations on the amount of profit that they can then be kicked back to investors. So a lot of the legal work, quite frankly, that we're doing and that the attorneys in the space are doing is on developing investment structures that are compatible with the nonprofit restrictions, but also allow, you know, for some fair return on the capital that's coming in. And it's challenging.
You know, you clear up some confusion, at least for me. You say, you know, on the federal level, of course, illegal. But what does that do for people that come to you for help? I mean, are they apprehensive about that? Is that something, does state law as we know it supersede that? I mean, what's your advice?
Well, actually, the opposite. Under the Constitution, it's the federal law that supersedes state law. But we're operating in a bit of a interesting framework right now. There's something called the Cole Memorandum. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. Man named Cole. Most people probably know who he is. I'm sure he was important. In the Obama Department of Justice, devised a policy that said, you know, the Department of Justice, like any other department of government, is a department of limited resources, and the department will not pursue criminal prosecution of business entities or any other entity operating under full compliance with a adequate state regulatory regime. So Massachusetts, Colorado, Washington, if you are a good actor in full compliance with your state laws, there is essentially an informal policy that doesn't carry the weight of a statute or regulation that the Federal Department of Justice will not criminally prosecute you. I'll say one other thing about medical real quick. And that's obviously an area that's a bit in flux because we have a new president and particularly a new attorney general who is not as receptive to the cannabis, you know, legalization. But recently in the budget bill that was just passed in Congress through funding government through September, and it has been the case for, I believe, multiple years in a row now, Congress has refused to appropriate any money to the Department of Justice to prosecute medical. Now I'm talking just about medical, not about recreational, which is coming online in Massachusetts, medical marijuana crimes. I think that there is a consensus even among the Trump Department of Justice that there will be no further infringement on medical marijuana markets.
I'll very quickly, 2 or 3 years ago, I was in California. I did a story on Harborside Medical in Oakland, which was a dispensary at the time. They were raided by the feds because you had a U.S. attorney out there who decided, you know, you have all this regulatory in place in California. I'm going to go in anyway. I mean, do people... I guess what I'm saying is it's, you know, you can say that there's, you can't say with 100% certainty that it would never happen. Right?
Of course not.
Yeah.
Of course not. And I think, quite frankly, the example you give would be, I'm not predicting that it will happen. I think actually news reports are slight suggesting that actually that the policies modeled around the Cole Memorandum will even remain in place. But I would say that the way that the Trump administration could chill this market as effectively as possible would be kind of a high profile raid, as you call it, against an actor in full compliance with the state with their state framework. I think it would scare capital away.
Jesse, just quickly, because we only have a minute left, who are your clients largely? Who are you representing? Dispensaries?
We've actually done a lot of work for investment groups, both doing diligence and deal structures. We also do represent medical licensees.
Right, that's what I meant.
Yeah, who are operating or close to operating on the medical laws. And then we also represent some ancillary businesses, some businesses that pop up, such as laboratories and things like that. Who will participate in the industry, although not, you know, in any way touching the product.
Give us the website where people can read more
You can go to foleyhoag.com and you can go to the Massachusetts Marijuana Council blog there. Perfect.
Jesse, we'll have you back to discuss this interesting stuff. I'm Tom Moroney with Ann Mostu. This is Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Moroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
That's right. This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mostu here in our Bloomberg 1200 studios in downtown Boston with my co-host Tom Moroney. And in studio with us is Alex Amuyel, Executive Director of MIT's Solve program, which connects leaders in tech, business, philanthropy, government, and civil society to crowdsolve global problems. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit more about what you do at Solve.
So Solve is an initiative of MIT to crowdsolve global challenges. And we do that by launching specific challenges. We have some around chronic diseases, carbon, refugee education, and a series of judges select the best solutions from our platform. And then those solutions, those innovators, come to pitch at one of our events. And then if they're selected, we introduce them to corporations, foundations, impact investors, social venture capitalists, people who have resources to help them fund and scale their solutions to a broader audience and to have a real impact in the world.
So you have a pool of people ready to give money, and they are they the ones deciding what goes forward?
Solve is this marketplace for social impact innovation. And we have on one side at the moment, we've selected 29 solvers. These are social entrepreneurs. And on the other side, and these are the people coming at Solve at MIT, which is happening May 8th to 10th, so this coming Monday, we have 400 people who are from foundations, from corporations, impact investors who are ready to invest. Now, the investments could be for-profit financial investments. They might also be nonprofit grant funding, and it might be that they're investing mentorship, technology, human capital, so also non-financial investments.
That's exciting. And are the solvers students or entrepreneurs or both?
It can be anybody around the world can submit an idea on our platform. Some of the people are MIT. There's a one solver, Kevin Kung. He's an MIT PhD student. Sure. And then there are a couple of solvers who are MIT alumni. But then most of them are not from MIT.
So, Alex, give us some examples of what they're trying to solve. What are the big issues here?
So one of the current challenges is around inclusive innovation and how do we ensure that technological change, such as automation, machine learning, which doesn't leave people behind and doesn't create further inequality, but helps integrate the marginalized or the people who don't have access to technology into jobs. So a couple of the solvers which have come up of this, we have something called Laboratoria, which is from Peru. And they have a course a bit like one of these coding academies, mm-hmm. but such as General Assembly, but they bring low-income women in Peru, and they there's a five-month course, and then they place them into jobs, and they get their money, so they're for-profit, they get their money by students repaying then their education once they have jobs and only if they have jobs. And so they're coming to Solve, and they're looking for technology companies, be they in Boston or anywhere else, where they can have partnerships to place the people that they've trained.
Well, so how many people altogether coming to Cambridge next week?
We have over 1,000 people coming to the opening plenary because that's open to Solve and to the MIT community. And then we have 400 people or more coming to the next 2 days, which are focused on working groups around these specific challenges.
So, Alex, you don't winnow down the field per se. Is it more, I hate to be crass about this, but like a dating service? In other words, you know, I'm an investor. I see something I like. They don't have to be one of your top 10 or anything. They could just go and have a chat with these people? Is it open like that, or is it more?
There's a couple of phases. So in the last cycle, we had over 400 solutions from 57 countries, and we did whittle it down to 29 solver teams. See. And those 29 solver teams are coming now to solve MIT.
And they could conceivably, all 29 could walk away with something.
Hopefully, they will. But yes, we're not a dating thing. But we do call ourselves matchmakers. We want to be the honest brokers connecting people in this social.
I wasn't too far off.
You weren't too far.
It's a fair analogy, Tom. So the end result is sometimes businesses. Do people end up spinning off businesses?
Absolutely. A good portion of our solutions are for-profit social enterprises. So the idea is that they are sustainable business models, which are still trying to have a positive and social and environmental impact in the world. We don't discriminate. You could be for-profit, not-for-profit. You could be part of an academic institution. You could be anywhere around the world.
So the big event, again, is coming up May 8th through 10th at MIT. Our guest in this segment has been Alex Amuyel, Executive Director of MIT's Solve. Thank you, Alex, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right, coming up, so many vacationers, so little help at the restaurants, spas, beaches, shops. We get the story from our Bloomberg reporter on a summer labor shortage. I'm Tom Maroney, along with my co-host, Ann Mastu. This is Bloomberg, 1294.5 FM HD2.
Listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mastu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
That's right. You are listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mastu in our Bloomberg 1200 studios in downtown Boston with my co-host Tom Maroney. And this week, Tom, I went to MIT to record a panel talk with Eric Schmidt, chairman of Alphabet, which is Google's parent company. He was there to talk about economic inclusion and skill set development, basically the role technology plays in helping to increase equity and build a more inclusive economy, sort of like we were talking about in the last segment.
Yeah, definitely.
And how these strategies can be further embedded into public policy and government workforce programs, for example. Here's part of that panel talk in which Schmidt talked about Google's hiring process.
Well, I'm not sure we're representative of the general case. We have a very, very explicit hiring process, which is pretty brutal, and it involves, you know, very detailed analysis of the candidates and a peer-based scoring system. And we've had various successes. You know, we had one fella who we interviewed 16 times before we said no to him. And so you can build there's like an error. And so you can build systems that can not waste his time and therefore ours, and find the right people and then go, we actually back solve against their performance. And there's a series of books about how doing this. And if you're running a company, you should at least study how we do it. It really works well. I've actually been thinking for a long time about the nature of these jobs. And while I would like everyone to become a PhD in computer science, I think it's unrealistic, even if the number one major at MIT is computer science, so thank you very much. It's an unrealistic goal, you know, across the broad population. But there's a different goal that might be achievable, which is a vast majority of, I'm going to call them normal people, as opposed to computer scientists, are going to be able to program computer systems to do powerful things. And there's a lot of reasons to believe that at the moment we're in a bespoke world of research where these new mechanisms require incredibly complicated judgment, highly specialized skills. And by the way, the same thing was true of the original building of airplanes, you know, and other things. And once the subroutines, once the procedures, once the submodules were all sort of figured out, they became accessible to mere mortals. And what I hope will be true in the next 5 to 10 years is that people with good organizational skills and good analytical skills will be able to program at the level that I could when I was a practicing computer scientist. And you say, well, how is that possible without a degree? And the answer is because the intelligence can be put below them and then they can just exploit it. In other words, if you think of the way to understand our language is we're building systems that learn to learn. Yeah. It should be possible for every single person to be able to build a system that learns something that's useful to them.
All right, that was Eric Schmidt of Alphabet, the parent company of Google. At this panel that Ann covered, he also announced a $500,000 gift to MIT's Inclusive Innovation Challenge. Joining us now for a discussion about a serious labor shortage this summer is Gina Smilek of Bloomberg News. She's based in Washington. Gina, good to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to talk about your story. You write about a shortage of stonemasons in Colorado, thoroughbred caretakers in Kentucky. Of course, we're at the Kentucky Derby weekend now. And waiters on Cape Cod right here in Boston. What's going on?
So there is this visa program called the H-2B, and it is a temporary program that allows workers to come in for seasonal jobs. So it brings in a lot of workers who don't have high skills. So think your carpenter, your mason, your attendant at a fair, those kinds of people who are needed and seasonally needed and often needed in these resort towns. Because one of the provisions that you have, one thing that you have to prove in order to get this visa is that you can't hire anyone locally. And so places like Cape Cod or Vail or places that are just kind of expensive because they're touristy and maybe tough for someone who's making, you know, $15 an hour or under to live, these places heavily use this visa in order to import seasonal workers.
Yeah, and it's an important and useful tool, I mean, for most employers. I remember when I was a reporter in Maine, there were a number of Eastern Europeans who used to go there. There were always a number of Irish young, often these are young people in college or finishing high school in their home country. We get a lot of Irish here. And then, of course, there are a lot of people on the Cape. So what are you seeing in terms of how they're trying to fill these jobs? I know you wrote about looking toward Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands.
Yeah, so this was actually a really interesting anecdote out of Cape Cod. So the whole Cape Cod and the islands, the whole Martha's Vineyard area as well, their Chamber of Commerce actually went down to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and tried to recruit workers, because the problem with H-2B is you have to apply every year. It's a, you know, it's a system that's capped and you might not get enough workers. It's a real question. So they thought that if, you know, we could hire Puerto Rican workers, it would be a much more reliable labor source that we would know is able to come every year because they're American citizens, and so we wouldn't have to worry about all this visa headache. And the tough thing is they went down there, and Puerto Ricans did not want to come for these jobs.
Mm.
So, what? Yeah, so they were having trouble enticing people up here, because it's not a great deal if you're an American citizen and you've got some broader economic opportunities, because, unfortunately, you know, it is expensive to live in these places. The jobs are temporary by nature. And so it's really difficult to entice actual Americans to move, is what they're saying. That's what they're reporting.
You know, Gina, I go up to the White Mountains in New Hampshire, and I was up there recently, and I stopped to have a sandwich at a place I like, and I was reading the local paper. I said to my wife, this newspaper, tiny little local paper, is jam-packed with help wanted ads. And, you know, so when I saw your story, I thought, aha, so this is not just happening at these typical resort areas. We mentioned Cape Cod, but anywhere where the economy, the local economy, needs this kind of help, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's really anywhere where there isn't a sufficient labor force to fill in jobs that fall into the sort of seasonal and mid to low skill range. So, like, it's not always necessarily places you would think of as big resort towns. One place that really, really uses a lot of these workers is actually the Chesapeake region for seafood harvesting. And another place that uses it is, you know, like the Louisiana coast heavily uses it during their heavy seafood season. And so it's used across the country for a variety of things. But the reason that we chose to focus on a couple of these resort towns is they're the ones that are really seeing the shortages this year, just because they apply for the summer visa, and the summer visa is the one that fills up really quickly. And so it completely filled up this year at March 13th, and so it's been a major concern for them.
It's just odd because so many of these workers want to return to their countries for schooling or whatever they plan to do after the summer's over. It's not that they're trying to immigrate here illegally, right?
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of these people come back year after year. And it's worth noting, and I should have noted earlier, so this was actually included in the funding bill that we saw signed into law today, actually. And so it is possible that there's relief coming to some of these companies. Based on the language in the new funding bill, the Secretary of Labor and a couple of other people within the government can make the determination that if there's a significant enough labor shortage in this fiscal year, they can move the cap up to about 130,000.
Right.
So it's possible. So these companies are looking towards some more hope. It's possible that this could get better this summer.
Well, that was you beat me to the punch on that one, Gina. But I also know that if you don't have enough help, you're going to have a clientele that's not happy with you. You're going to lose money. I know this wasn't part of your story, but maybe you can comment on this. You know, I wonder how many people, you said they went to Puerto Rico, not much luck there. I wonder, because of the immigration discussion debate going on now, that people are just fearful of even coming here to take advantage of these programs. Any sense of that in your reporting, that they couldn't make these quotas anyway because people said, I'm not going to the United States?
You know, I don't think that that has been an issue for this particular visa program. And I would suspect that one of the reasons why is because this is very much the kind of visa where people return year after year after year. And they sort of have a pattern established. They have a relationship with these employers. They have a relationship with the community that they're living in. And so I think that if any visa category was susceptible to that, it probably wouldn't be this one.
And you have a great chart, Gina, with your story, which I'm sure people can find on the terminal and on Bloomberg.com, showing who works H-2B jobs. And the number one most popular position is landscaping and groundskeeping workers. And after that, and that's 49%. And after that, it's about 6% maids and housekeepers, forest conservation workers, amusement rec attendants, construction laborers. And then it goes on to talk about the food and livestock sort of areas. But it sounds like it'll be hard for people to find someone to mow their lawn this summer.
Yeah, so and again, like I was saying earlier about how some of these jobs are maybe not typical resort town jobs. Lawnmowers, like you said, are one of the really predominant ones, and in some areas, that's almost exclusively what they're used for. So, USCIS actually keeps great data. The State Department actually keeps great data on what jobs different regions are using. And then one thing that really struck me about that data is it's very concentrated. So like some parts of the South exclusively use this visa for lawnmowers, and some parts of the Northeast exclusively use it for fish harvesting. And so it is interesting, you know, it's going to be specific industries in the areas, in different areas throughout the country.
Depending on what those regions need. Gina Smilek of Bloomberg News, thanks for your help. Great story. We can check it out
on
Bloomberg.com or the Bloomberg Terminal. Coming up next week, as we mentioned at the top of the show, Bloomberg's TV technology show is here in Boston. We'll be broadcasting live from 5 to 6 here on Bloomberg 1200 in our time spot. A week later, we go Monday through Friday, Ann Mostu.
I can't wait.
This is Bloomberg.